Today, there's been an uprising and then a crackdown. What is happening in Venezuela? And, in opinion, columnist Owen Jones on the privilege of private schools and who gets into Britain's elite universities.
So I got a very early morning phone call from Jamie Wilson, the foreign editor, at about 5:30 last Tuesday on the 30th of April, and jumped out of bed. And it was one of those, because we've been covering Venezuela so much and this is the big story of the region, my first thought was, something's happening in Caracas. And then immediately logged onto social media, and the first thing I saw, because everybody was talking about it, was this video.
Pueblo de Venezuela, muy buenos días. Como ustedes saben, nuestra lucha ha estado siempre...
In which Juan Guaido appeared. He said in, but actually outside a big military airbase in Caracas with some armed men behind him. And first thought when I see that is, it's game over for Maduro.
That first instinctive reaction by The Guardian's Latin America correspondent Tom Phillips was shared by much of the world's media. There was a sense that this dramatic early morning scene would mark the end for Nicolas Maduro's reign. 2 weeks on, and Venezuela still has the same leader, while several opposition figures linked to Juan Guaido have gone into hiding or been detained. But this story is complex and ongoing, with claims and counterclaims about conversations suggesting senior figures in the Venezuelan government may have been tempted to defect, leaving Maduro paranoid and Guaido still hopeful. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, a Venezuelan crisis that is not over yet.
There has been a slow burn political crisis in Venezuela for absolutely years, but it really exploded in January when Juan Guaido, who is the head of the opposition-controlled National Assembly here, was just catapulted on into national, international headlines when he declared himself Venezuela's legitimate interim president on the basis that last year's presidential elections, which had returned Nicolas Maduro to office for another 6 years, had been fraudulent, and therefore, as president of Venezuela's opposition-controlled National Assembly, Guaido therefore had the authority to take on the role of president on a temporary basis until fresh, free and fair elections could be held. Juan Guaido was supported by dozens of governments around the world, including the US, most Latin American governments and Britain, and launched this big push to get Maduro out of power. Maduro, of course, has been president here since 2013 when he took over from Hugo Chavez after Chavez's death. And Maduro has led Venezuela into utter collapse. Millions of Venezuelans have fled the country. The economy has absolutely collapsed. And then along comes Guaido and sets up this showdown, which suddenly burst into the open on the morning of April 30th.
Opposition leader Juan Guaido calling for the military to oust the sitting president, Nicolas Maduro. In an early morning video, Guaido saying, quote, "The moment is now," calling for his supporters to take to the streets, and many answering that call.
Tear gas canisters fired into this crowd in Venezuela, reaction to the country's opposition leader Juan Guaido calling for a military uprising.
Now, in Venezuela, there have been clashes outside a military base in the capital, Caracas. The authorities say that they're dealing with what they say is an attempted coup.
So in the video, you see Juan Guaido talking to the camera. To his right, as you look at the image, you see Leopoldo López, who is one of the most prominent opposition leaders here in Venezuela. And behind them, a group of uniformed soldiers with assault rifles and some of them wearing blue armbands that represent their defection from Maduro to Guaido's side.
So at first, it looks good for Guaido. I mean, the fact that Leopoldo López is there is significant because he's been under house arrest, and that suggests someone influential organised his release. And then we learn that the head of Venezuela's secret police, Manuel Ricardo Christopher Figuera, has defected. How significant is that?
He was the head of SEBIN, the Bolivarian Intelligence Service, which is a very feared and sprawling spy organisation and, you know, one of Maduro's inner circle. So he was, we are now told, one of several very, very big fish who had been locked in secret talks for weeks. And he did jump ship in the end. The others didn't.
And things start to go really wrong for Guaido. He calls people to the streets to support what he calls Operation Freedom. They come, but events don't unfold in the way that he hoped.
Clearly the plan was, go to the airbase in the morning, spark a massive nationwide military uprising, and then march west across Caracas to the doors of the presidential palace from which Maduro has fled. And it is clear by the end of Tuesday that that has not happened in any shape or form.
During the day, the US said the attempt had almost worked. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo claimed Maduro was poised to leave for exile in Cuba, but was talked out of it by Moscow.
He had an airplane on the tarmac. He was ready to leave this morning, as we understand it, and the Russians indicated he should stay.
I'd like to speak to all patriotic citizens of Venezuela, whether you're civilians or members of the military.
And then National Security Advisor John Bolton began to name members of the Venezuelan government who he suggested may have been talking to the opposition.
To Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino, to Chief Judge of the Supreme Court Miguel Moreno, and Commander of the Presidential Guard Rafael Hernandez Dala.
Did all of that help Maduro characterize this as a US-backed coup?
I think absolutely all of that helps Maduro sell this as a US-backed conspiracy. That has always been their line since this challenge from Guaido began in January, but it's really, really ramped up recently.
And I'm joined by the man we recognize as president, Señor Guaido.
Particularly, actually, with Guaido's appearances. I mean, he's constantly on Fox News.
I got to remember to ask these questions in English, too, as I jump into Spanish talking to you. But ¿cómo está su esposa y su niña?
Well, very worried, of course, with all these risks and this possibility.
But even as it looks like this attempt is failing, Maduro must be feeling really paranoid. I mean, his spy chief has switched sides. There are secret talks between government figures and the opposition. Do we know what he's doing during all of this?
Well, that really is the question. I interviewed someone this week, former Venezuelan politician, and they said, if my intelligence chief turned on me, I'd be scared shitless. And I suspect the honest answer is, Maduro was thinking, goodness, you know, what the hell is going on? Who can I trust? He summons fairly early on his aides and ministers to Miraflores, the presidential palace, because we subsequently learned that actually some of the real key figures around Maduro had supposedly been part of this conspiracy. So you can also imagine that Maduro is putting in some pretty awkward calls on Tuesday morning saying, is this true?
And Tom, have you been able to establish what was actually happening behind the scenes?
The reality is, we do not know what was going on. We still don't know what was going on in the presidential palace. We still don't know what actually happened in those hours or days. I don't think anyone, apart from a very small group around Guaido and a very small group around Maduro, understands what happened, what was going on, who was talking to who was part of the plot, who wasn't, who was a double agent. It's still so confused. And one senses that maybe Maduro doesn't even know himself yet.
So Maduro wakes up on Tuesday, April the 30th, thinking that he could be in big trouble. By the next day, a very different picture has started to emerge.
Tuesday afternoon, Wednesday morning, you have the opposition in retreat. You have Leopoldo López, who's taken shelter first in the residence of the Chilean ambassador and then in the Spanish ambassador's residence. You have security forces who were supposed to switch sides actually remaining almost entirely loyal to Maduro and moving out onto the streets to clamp down on the protests. So that's the initial crackdown. And on the face of it, it is successful. Maduro stays in power. The protests are snuffed out by and large, and a very odd calm returns to Caracas.
So, you've touched down in Caracas. There's been that crackdown against the early protests, but no move against Guaido himself. And by the end of the first week, he is calling people again out to the streets, asking military figures to defect. You went to a protest on Saturday. What was that like?
There was a lot of singing, there was a lot of shouting, there was a lot of enthusiasm and defiance and people saying, well, it didn't happen on Tuesday, but, you know, let's keep going. But in reality, where I was, there were maybe 300 people, half of them journalists. And we were being circled constantly by members of the Bolivarian National Guard, and that, you know, they were there protesting for a few hours, and then everybody went home back to more uncertainty.
And how did the people feel who you met? I mean, were they frustrated, upset, scared?
There was a real mix of emotion. So there was, of course, defiance, but there was also anger. Actually, anger at the opposition. There was frustration, for example, about the very prominent role that Leopoldo López, the opposition leader, played in it. Several people we spoke to thought that that might have been one of the reasons that it had gone wrong, because many on the Chavista side see Leopoldo López as being an absolutely toxic figure who will come after them if he ever gets into power. So there was frustration at that, and there was also frustration that people hadn't really known and don't still know what was going on, and an impression that actually, beyond a very small group of people around Guaido, most of the opposition was left in the dark, didn't know this was coming, and feels, frankly, a bit excluded from the process.
Okay, so you'd been to the protests in favour of Guaido, more muted than what you'd seen in the past. What did you do next?
So we went to this hotel in Downtown Caracas. It used to be the Hilton, but was taken over back in the Chavez era by the party and has become a sort of a headquarters for them where they hold their events. We walked in and there's portraits of Chavez everywhere behind reception in front of us, and there are these big posters of Comandante's eyes all over the walls. So you have people wandering around the corridors of this hotel, and under their arms they've got newspapers that have, in English, Trump not today written on them.
Viva Chavez! Viva Maduro! Viva la patria! Viva! Viva siempre! Viva! Viva siempre! Viva siempre!
And going around shouting the slogan that we now hear constantly here in Venezuela, which is Leales siempre, traidores nunca, always loyal, never traitors. Viva Chavez, viva Maduro. So there is this, on the surface of it, this real confidence that this problem has gone away. But I think deep down, these people know that actually it hasn't gone away at all. And this thing is very much alive still.
Do we know where opposition leaders are, or defectors?
So we're now into the second week, and we are starting to see signs of Maduro's pushback against those who took part in this uprising. We have 10 opposition politicians who are being accused of a really long list of crimes, including treason, inciting rebellion. Some of them start to seek shelter inside the residences of foreign ambassadors here in Caracas.
Jorge Luis, he tomado el teléfono para leer textual el tuit de Edgar Zambrano de hace media hora, un poquito menos, 28 minutos exactamente.
And then on Wednesday night, we have very dramatic and frankly odd scenes where members of the intelligence service descend on Edgar Zambrano, who's the number two in Guaido's National Assembly, and also someone who was on the bridge that morning, to detain him. He refuses to get out of his car, and then they proceed to tow his car all the way to El Helicoide, which is a very notorious political prison here in Caracas. So, I mean, that was a very bizarre scene, and you now have a number of politicians holed up in diplomatic residences here, and many of them have gone to ground.
So the question is, why did Guaido's attempt fall flat? I mean, he had this defection of a very senior figure, the top guy in the intelligence community. This weekend, Maduro came out to denounce Figueira, but it does sound like other senior figures were talking to the opposition. So who does Guaido need to defect for this to be successful? And is there any chance that that could still happen?
So there is a growing list of alleged conspirators who have been named by different newspapers and different people here. They include the head of the Supreme Court, the defense minister, the head of military intelligence, and a few other very big names. They have come out and denied that that is true and declared their loyalty to Maduro. And frankly, we just don't know. I mean, my sense is, from talking to people here and talking to some people with very good connections to the Maduro regime, is that there were secret talks that were going on for quite some time, and they did involve very, very, very big names. Guaido will be trying to work out why those people didn't switch last Tuesday, and if they can still be convinced to do so, or if others can be convinced to do that. The United States has made a big move this week in trying to ensure that there is still life in this by announcing that it was withdrawing sanctions from Figueira, the spy chief who did jump ship. And that is a clear sign to other big figures in the Venezuelan armed forces that if they turn on Maduro, they will receive similarly favourable treatment from Washington.
Why is the Trump administration so keen to support Guaido?
A coalition of 54 countries, most Latin American governments, European governments, have backed Guaido and are against Maduro. And that is for two simple reasons. Well, one simple reason, they believe Maduro stole last year's election, is not legitimate. And the second reason, Venezuela has collapsed. This is a country that has failed. Lives are being lost. Millions are flooding out of the country. But then there are also less noble reasons, which, as I say, they don't really bother to hide. This Trump's war against socialism and his desire to get Latin American voters, particularly Cubans and Venezuelans. And of course, the White House has never enjoyed Chavismo. I mean, there have been undoubtedly constant attempts to destabilize and to get rid of Chavismo here. So it's part of a long-running battle that has been ramped up. And now you have people like John Bolton speaking and Marco Rubio whispering into Donald Trump's ear on what he should do down here, and they are taking a very hawkish line.
What are they whispering in Trump's ear? Is there any possibility of US military intervention?
Well, it certainly seems that John Bolton is whispering that in Trump's ear.
We want, as our principal objective, the peaceful transfer of power. But I will say again, as the president has said from the outset, and that Nicolas Maduro and those supporting him, particularly those who are not Venezuelan, should know, is all options are on the table.
But despite all of this, Maduro hasn't moved to arrest Guaido.
Most people think that speaks to the fact that if Maduro tries to detain Guaido, two things might happen. One, that really might spark some sort of major movement from the armed forces who are sort of moving in Guaido's direction. But more importantly, it might spark some sort of US military retaliation or some big escalation, at least, which Maduro is trying to avoid.
And then 10 days after all of this began on Friday, you interviewed Guaido. Tell us about that.
I made my way down there expecting to find a pretty frazzled and stressed out guy, given everything that has gone on over the past few days. He's a guy whose wife and daughter are now living outside of Venezuela because of the pressure he is under, who has seen several of his close allies flee into foreign embassies or the country or be detained in the last few days. A couple of days earlier, someone who'd met him commented to me that they'd seen Guaido and thought he came across as someone who just got back from his summer holidays on the beach. And I thought that was a rather strange thing to say. Actually, it really is how he came across. Buenos días, complicados. He was upbeat, he was confident, he was calm, immaculately dressed as always, with perfectly ironed shirt and a grey suit and a turquoise tie, looking very snappy and very unflappable, unexpectedly. He didn't want to go into too much detail about what had gone wrong on the 30th of April and why and how he felt about that. What he wanted to do was hammer home the message that this much more of a temporary setback rather than a defeat, as Maduro has tried to claim. As I got up at the end of the interview and started leaving the room, I turned back towards him to say goodbye, and he gave me a very, very big grin and then lifted up his left arm and flashed me a V for victory sign.
That sounds pretty optimistic, given how badly things went for him. Do you really think this is rumbling on?
While it seems suspiciously quiet some days here in Caracas now, there isn't much news. Apparently, not much is going on. But behind the scenes, my God, there is a story playing out at the moment, and we're not going to know how it ends until it ends. But it didn't end on the 30th of April. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do keep up with Tom Phillips' reporting at theguardian.com. Coming up, the bitter row over widening access to the universities of Oxford and Cambridge. Welcome back. Now, the fact that a higher proportion of students from state schools are winning places at Britain's top universities has not been welcomed in some parts of Britain's private school system. The headmaster of Stow School told a newspaper, "The rise of populists has created a micro-industry in bashing private schools." He then went on to compare the treatment of private pupils to the Nazis' persecution of Jews. Columnist Owen Jones responds.
I read the story and I was pretty stunned. The very idea that somebody with a straight face could compare the expansion of educational access and more pupils, a very small rise of pupils from state schools going to Oxbridge, is somehow akin to Nazism. Where do you even start from there? But I also thought it was telling of how those with privilege, when they fear that their privilege is in any sense threatened, they kind of drape themselves in the garbs of victimhood. And this is quite an extreme example. The irony of social engineering being bandied around on this front page is that I can't think of a more striking example of social engineering other than private education. If you look at the actual statistics, whilst only 7% of the nation's children attend private schools, at Oxford, and this is after the rise of state school students, 41.8% of Oxford students hail from a private school. So they're dramatically overrepresented. And actually, even then, if you cut out, for example, the grammar school educated pupils, less than 40% of Oxford students are comprehensively educated, unlike 90% of the rest of the population. And also what the evidence shows is that state school students actually do better on average at university than their privately educated counterparts. So that just goes to show that if we're going to talk about social engineering, then private education is a good place to start, not attempts which are not going anywhere near far enough to expand educational access. I think basically private schools prey on the fears and insecurities of people from privileged backgrounds who often fear that if their children are going to schools with people from different backgrounds, that somehow will make their education suffer, or sometimes that they'll be rejected. So I'm a state-educated student from Stockport, and I went on to study history at Oxford University. And, you know, I remember someone from a private school saying to me, well, the only reason state school students like myself got into Oxbridge was because of quotas. There is this sense of insecurity people get from, or we all get. We all want to believe that we got to where we are in life because we deserved it. So if we think to ourselves that odds are stacked in our favour, that obviously makes us feel insecure and upset, because we all want to believe we got here on our own steam, because of our natural talent and ability. And when that starts to be questioned, it makes people often very, very defensive indeed. It's almost like a personal insult that someone is suggesting, well, actually, you may well have certain talents or skills, but you also have to factor in you have certain advantages which other people do not have, which partly explains why you're in the position you're in and they're not. And that, of course, explains why so many of the leading professions in Britain are out of kilter. They're not representative. They're socially exclusive. And it's hard often to challenge that, because you get such a defensive reaction from people who feel quite upset when the fact they're the beneficiaries of certain privileges is in any way highlighted, let alone challenged.
That was Owen Jones. You can read his column on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Owen and to Tom Phillips in Caracas. This episode was produced by Brenna Daldorf and Rachel Humphreys, with special thanks to Carmen Martinez Lopez for help with translation. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.